Radio St. Pete presents Typewriter Talks with Maureen McDowell, founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit.
Hello, welcome to Typewriter Talks. This podcast features interviews with writers, poets, and other bookish folks. My name is Maureen McDowell, and I am the founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit, which is a literary arts organization based in St. Petersburg, Florida. On Typewriter Talks, we discuss all kinds of writerly topics, hoping to show you that there is not one right way to be a writer. Today, we are happy to welcome Brian Wedlake. After decades of living in the fashion world as a model and a professional actor in Hollywood, he moved back to Florida in 2014 with his family, where he picked up the pen again, which he hasn't done since he won the North American Poetry Award at age 19. In 2022, he was awarded first place Writer's Digest annual writing competition and named a finalist in the 2021 Hemingway Shorts Literary Journal competition. He is nearing completion on his debut novel, Emery's Rule, which is a coming-of-age story wrapped inside a treasure hunt. It has since been longlisted top 1% of submissions in the 2022 Master's Review Novel Excerpt Contest. He and his wife live on a 21-acre farm in Florida with their two children, surrounded by nature. Welcome, Brian.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Maureen.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm excited to have this conversation with you and get to know you a little better. And tell us what you're working on right now.
Well, as you so eloquently said there, I'm working on finishing my debut novel. It's been a marathon, as you know, probably at about 5 years of thinking about it and maybe 3 years of writing about it. And I've just recently begun querying agents and got my first ask from an agent and review and getting close. I thought I was a lot closer to the finish line, but I still have work to do, which is good. I want it to be done and right. It's my first and potentially only novel. But it is a coming of age story wrapped inside a treasure hunt. And I don't want to say it's autobiographical, but it certainly, as most novels are, is very close to home.
That's exciting. Why are you saying that it might be your only novel?
That's a good question. I guess I maybe didn't even mean to say that. I guess coming into this, I had something I wanted to say. A story grabbed me. The opportunity presented itself. I've worked really, really hard at putting this together, but I think I've just tried to be simple about it and say that, you know, I want to do one at a time. I love writing, but when the pressure exists to get something complete and, you know, sell or get readers, I think it starts to squeeze the joy out of it. So as I've neared the completion of this, I've just tried to take the pressure off of anything beyond this. I want this to feel like something that I'm very proud of that lives on and people enjoy and get something out of. But I'm just trying to take the pressure off of myself of doing it again.
Yeah, and it is the first time you've ever done this, so I think
we don't
realize, like, when you're learning something new, how uncomfortable that is. And when we're in it, it's just like very stressful to learn something new.
Completely.
And then, yeah. And then when your next book comes around, which I believe it will, you'll kind of already know this process. I mean, you have two kids, right? So you know, with the second kid, it was easier than the first.
Yes, exactly. And I always bring stuff back to that because I think most people can relate, not everybody, but people who have a kid, you don't have to be a writer to understand that, you know, having one child is a lot. And it's a beautiful thing when you're lucky enough to be able to do that. And so I feel a lot like this novel is a child, and I just want to be able to get it out there into the world and then see about number two.
But oftentimes,
we all ask, kind of, you're dating someone and then, well, when are you getting married, or you're married, or, well, when are you going to have a child? And then,
yeah,
as I had my first, often people would say, are you guys going to, we had a boy. So the question was, are you going to go for a girl? And it was just kind of like, well, let's just hang on a sec. Let's see.
Let's be in it. Let's be in the moment. Yeah. There's always that, like, well, this isn't enough. Let's do something next.
It's
that's
natural.
Nice.
We all do.
Yeah.
It's natural.
And you mentioned that you wrote poetry when you were younger. Are you drawn to poetry still?
Not really, not really. I love poetry. I have to be really honest and say that I don't enjoy reading it. I'm not a great reader myself, and oftentimes when I'm reading poetry, I get a little lost, heady, float away, if you will. But I think just naturally for me, and it probably just came from a school assignment, you know, write a poem, write a limerick, write this or that. And I think we were all in elementary school, maybe started out on short stories and poems. So that felt natural to me. And I think that's just probably why I started with that. But I have not written a poem in a very long time.
So you're more of, so when you're more of a novelist, were you with this story of your debut novel, did you hear like the characters' voices or did you hear the plot? How did it get going for you?
It came, I have to say also, just maybe just bigger picture for myself. I do not consider myself a writer. I do not have an MFA. I did not go to school to study writing in particular. I'm a horrible reader. It takes a lot for me to read. I have not, I'm embarrassed to say, but sort of want to shout that from the mountaintops that you don't have to be an incredible reader or drawn to literature to tell a story. But I do, I have been very lucky with the people who've guided me. Nicole Caron has been absolutely instrumental. I literally could not have done this without her guidance. And she is a college professor, as you know, an amazing writer, in her own world. And I needed that guidance. But I say that to say, to answer your question, Nicole said, after going to Keep St. Pete Lit and meeting Nicole, who was guiding a class, I walked up to her afterward and I was struggling with how to start telling my story. And after a couple of conversations with her, she just said, why don't you just, in 5,000 words, just kind of like, don't worry about writing a novel, just kind of like write down what happened to you. And so I did that, and 5 or 10,000 words spilled out of me, and it was just very easy, and it came out in first person. I didn't choose which voice to write it in. It just came out as me, and the protagonist was actually Brian in the very beginning, in the first couple of drafts. We since shaped that into a better narrative and a better story, and so I slowly stripped myself away from that. But I would say that it came from actually finding a shipwreck on the bottom of Bocasiega Bay, and that was the impetus for me to write this story.
Well, going back to your comment about not having an MFA, and also I don't have an MFA, and I went to school for English, so I didn't technically study writing, and I've written 3 books of poetry, and I'm very specific about the poetry that actually responds to me. A lot of it is too heady for me, and I kind of get lost in the language a bit much. I like pretty straightforward writing. So I think that you're showing, and you know, some people don't process information the same, so maybe audible books are better for you than actually reading. But you do obviously have a story in you to tell, so you are a writer, to be clear. And I mean, I don't think you would have gone this far in you have a full website, like you're on this podcast and really excited about it. When I was emailing you, you were really excited about everything. Like, you're a writer, because you're not gonna, for somebody who, as I know, you have a 21-acre farm in Florida, that's not somebody that just does something half as, how do you say that? I can't say that word.
Haphazardly,
Yeah, half, thank you. I was gonna
or
say
half-assed.
half-assed. Yeah, half-assed. So if you've made it this far, then you clearly are a writer. So anyone else who's out there that's listening that thinks you have to have certain credentials or check certain boxes to be a writer, I will argue with you if you feel the need to argue with
Thank
me.
you.
But yes. So we've got that out of the way. Tell us
Yes.
what a typical day looks like for you as a writer.
Well, as you said, I've got 2 kids and I've got a farm and a job and happily married and have a lot of other things going on. I will tell you that I feel like very lucky in that I can write in lots of different places at lots of different times. And I think that's just, I hear that often with first time novelists where you just kind of have to get it in where you can. So, yeah. You know, the perfect time frame for me would be to wake up late and have a cup of coffee and sit in my office and get it out. But I often write at coffee shops or a Panera or at the airport waiting for a flight, or honestly with the kids shooting Nerf guns throughout the house. I've been able to just hunker down and get the words down. So it's very atypical. Every day is different for me.
Well, that's how it is for a lot of us that have to, yeah, that weren't born with a trust fund, which, you know, sometimes I think about that, like, would I even want that life? Because it's kind of the hardships and the challenges and that have shaped you, that informs the writing. Not that those of you that are out there that have trust funds aren't writers. I'm not saying that, but for me personally,
Let's even go as far as to say that, back to the question of the first or the second novel, how will I do with an opportunity, let's say a book advance, to write another one? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how that will be if I get the vacuum and I can just sit and plunk away. I have been doing this in a way that I have a lot of other things going on. So to be retired and to be independently wealthy and to have a book deal, that might not feel fun. I don't know.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. To go down that rabbit hole. Like if I had the opportunity to just write full time, I'm sure I would come up with some event somewhere or some book club or some extra side project. Yeah. So it's interesting to realize that. So how has your writing process changed over the years? Like from when you first started, when you, you know, were just getting ready to write, into now?
Yeah. I think, just to very quickly go back to the beginning, I kind of like wrote from my mom standing over my shoulder and saying, write, you do this pretty well, and your teachers have asked you to do more of it. And I just kind of did it robotically. And then I took one college class, a poetry class, and that teacher was incredible. And she was very good at getting me to be more specific. And that changed the way that I was writing a lot. Now, again, I took a lot of time off, but I would say just being more specific has probably, over the arc of however long I've been writing, the more specific I can. And I know that everybody's not like this, but for me, as vulnerable as I can be, as honest as I can be, I really like to read that stuff. I really am drawn to nonfiction or historical fiction and novels that you can just tell someone's unzipped their soul there. And I just feel like I probably wouldn't be very into writing something that I wasn't like really personally going through or connected to.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense, because I think that the books that we tend to be drawn to sometimes reflect who we are. Like the poetry I like to read reflects similar to the poetry that I like to write.
Right. I even heard a reader say once that they didn't say they only read first time authors, but they love to read first time novelists because it's just, you know, it's the kitchen sink book. It's just got it all. It's got it all in there.
Yeah. And they're not so polished and
right,
all the things like that. That makes sense. How, so you own a 21 acre farm. How does that inform your writing?
Completely. I think just in the effort, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood and I love neighborhoods, but living on a basically raw piece of land now, we just see the other side of the fence. We see the bobcats coming. Like I can tell by the number of squirrels that are in the oak trees, whether there's a bobcat on the property or not. And it's incredible. You just start to get completely in tune with weather and which way the wind is blowing and what tracks are across your gravel driveway. And I would say that connection to nature is everywhere in everything I've written and hopefully everything I ever write. But yeah, I think there's a lot to learn there. And you know, just being in Florida, there's so much development I just feel really lucky to be on this little special piece of land.
Yeah, and I think about Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings and how Cross Creek was such a instrumental narrative device for her writing. And is your debut novel have like, is the sense of place really strong in it of your farm, or is it takes place in a different setting? Because it's Bogusiega Bay. So that's
right. Yeah. Well, it does. It's both. So it's about a little boy who grows up on a very special piece of land, which is not this land, but I set that on the Jungle Prada area where the middens are, mm-hmm. you know, the
yeah,
sacred
yeah.
lands.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the
there.
Little, were you really?
I was married. Yeah. Saffron.
Incredible.
Used to be there. Yeah, we took my family's boat, Hubbard's Marina, which actually was the boat that would take you out to Egmont Key, and then
incredible.
Got married on that little piece of property. Yeah, yeah. But go ahead.
I love it there. I love the tours, and I love what they've done and how they're trying to save that. So Emery, in my story, Emery grows up there, but he runs away and stows himself away aboard his grandfather's sailboat. So he lives in between this raw land that he loves and on the bay at anchor with his grandfather, amidst this modern day version of pirates. And so I kind of play with both worlds, and you'll definitely see, I guess, just author's note, how much I love my own land and how I want it to be preserved and just how important, but also I love boating too. So I love being out on the water as well.
Do you think this would be a series?
I don't think so. I guess in theory, like anything could be, because you know, you could run something from before, you could take a character's life before or after. There again, like I just think it's a standalone, and if an opportunity came, I would consider something else. But no, I think it's its own thing. I would prefer it to be its own thing.
Well, that's cool. That's good to realize that this is a standalone piece of writing. And it's always interesting. We interviewed Nathan Van Koops earlier, and he was talking about he's really big in series, and how people love to follow a character. They fall in love with the character. They like the adventure of series, but then they like the stability of knowing a character. And that you follow this character through a whole experience. And that's why I was asking, because I mean, I haven't read your book, but we're going to hear some of it. I also think, as you were talking about, like having this piece of land, like how great to write, like I thought of Thoreau and Walden Pond, of using your piece of land as a inspiration for, because you read nonfiction, a nonfiction piece. Not that I'm telling you what to write, but I was like, man, you have so many, like you have such a rich pot of things to pull from for your
yes.
writing life. And I mean, even
lucky.
Just talking about like what you've experienced, like I never thought about that with the squirrels in the trees and knowing if there's a bobcat back around. And even like in South St. Pete, my sister said that an osprey like decapitated someone's little chihuahua, and it's like you can't have your pets. And then there's coyotes with cats, and it's like the wild is all around us.
Yeah,
we're so socialized to be in this very like concrete jungle.
Yeah,
but I love that. I mean, you're just over the bridge from St. Pete in Palmetto.
25 yeah. minutes from downtown, but
I know
literally a world away. And
so wild.
I simultaneously like loathe the development going on literally surrounding us, like farmers have sold and houses have gone up. But I also love the fact, like I think of the little house in Up, the Pixar movie Up, with the little old man who like hangs on. And I feel like our land is that, and animals have access through tunnels and under bridges and along two creeks that they can still get here. But we are completely surrounded by, warehouse and development and neighborhoods and, you know, people who probably shoot at the bobcats when they walk, you know, threaten their kids, as they should be concerned. But at the same time, it's just a unique living situation that my kids are growing up in, and I just feel so lucky to be here.
That's so great. So let's hear some of your writing.
Okay. Well, so you alluded to the novel, which I can do, and depending on time, I have a story that I wrote and was a finalist in the Hemingway Shorts collection and was published. And I got to read the piece in Oak Park at Hemingway's birthplace house. I got to read it in Key West at his home. And then I was in out in Idaho, in Ketchum, Idaho, and I got to read it and leave a copy inscribed at his gravesite. Because it is May and it is Mental Health Awareness Month, I would love to be able to read this short story today, if you're okay with time. It's yeah, about a 10-minute read.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. We'd love to hear it.
Great. It's called When the Sun Sets. It really is a beautiful place. The man breathed in the salt air that traveled west toward the Gulf of Mexico. He shielded his eyes from the bright yellow sun above an island at the mouth of the bay. A white lighthouse blinked and broke the flat line of the horizon like a heartbeat. "I haven't been there in a long time," she said. "Where do you live?" He wondered what she looked like and if her face matched the rounded features of her voice. "I live far from the coast, as far away as one can get. I don't know why someone would live away from the coast." "The inside of the state is beautiful, too," she said. "You should take some time to see it." "Why would I? I love the salt air." "What do you love about it?" She took a sip of a drink and swallowed. "The beaches are so crowded and full of tourists." "I hate the beaches. The tourists can have them." He turned to look at the traffic and wondered if someone would stop soon. A red truck streaked like a paintbrush across the concrete canvas behind him. "But the salt air reminds me of happy times. Isn't that ironic?" She nodded in agreement, even though he couldn't see her. "What time does the sun set today?" he asked. The woman paused and made a clinking noise with her tongue against the roof of her mouth, but said nothing. "Hello?" He squinted at the red receiver and tapped the part he spoke into. "I don't know. I thought you couldn't hear me." "I heard you. But the sun sets at different times in different places." "Isn't it silly that we say the sun sets? The sun doesn't set. The sun doesn't do anything but burn and frame the happy part of a life. He used to read the paper every morning when he had a family, and that was the first thing he checked after the weather." "You really don't know what time the sun sets?" "I don't know what time your sun sets." "Aren't you supposed to have all the answers?" "I don't have all the answers." She peeked out a window and wished her sun would set. "Are you still there?" he asked. "I'm here," she said softly. But she wasn't thinking about the sunset or the new bridge. She was thinking about the old one. "Why don't you live near the beaches?" "I told you, I hate the beaches, the same as you." "I didn't hear you say that. Besides, the tourists all go home in May." "That's not the only reason I don't live along the coast," she said. "Why do you live there?" "I told you, I love the salt air." "But why?" "My father used to take me fishing when I was a boy. He loved to troll for mackerel in the springtime." A single-engine airplane dragged a large banner from the beaches back over the bay. He focused on the plane struggling against the headwind blowing from behind him. "I really hate the tourists." "So do I." "You're not very good at this, are you?" "Why do you say that? Shouldn't you be more positive?" He took a deep breath and held it until his lungs burned. "And you should know some things." "Like what?" "The time the sun sets, for one thing." The amber hazard lights of his boxy hatchback blinked at him further down the slope of the new bridge, but no one stopped. "I wonder what they'll do with my car." "What do you want them to do with it?" He felt alone again as he watched the plane struggle, and he knew the sun would set soon, and he thought about the tourists and how much they ruin things. "You haven't even asked me why I'm here." "Why are you there?" "It makes a difference if you have to be asked to ask a question." "You're right. I'm sorry." He remembered that he was the one calling her from the bridge. "No, it's my fault." The sun glowed as it settled below a thin layer of clouds above the horizon, and the blue sky darkened. The lighthouse blinked, and he counted. 1 Mississippi. 2 Mississippi. 3 Mississippi. It blinked again. "Is it on all day?" "Is what on all day?" "The lighthouse." She didn't want to think about the lighthouse or the bridge or how difficult it is to navigate in and out of the bay. You really don't know anything, do you? But she knew a lot. You should know a few things. Just make something up for all I care. Is that what you want me to do? She enjoyed bantering with him and began to wonder what he looked like. I don't care what you do. I'm going to do it anyway, and then it won't matter if you know anything or why we count by saying Mississippi or what the sun does. The lighthouse reminds me of something I don't like to talk about. I suppose we all have our problems, don't we? His arm grew tingly, so he moved the red receiver from one hand to the other. He looked down at the old bridge, which was missing its middle. Men fished from the north and south spans on either side of the shipping channel. The sky above the horizon burned, and the lighthouse flashed at him like one does when they're looking for something in the dark. I suppose it's on all day in case of a storm or a fog. Yes, I know a lot about that. The woman thought about the morning and the cargo ship and the captain who made the mistake. You don't think I'll do it. I'll do it, and then you'll see how little you know. He held his breath for 10 blinks of the lighthouse. I don't want to drown. Do you think it will hurt? I don't know. Aren't you supposed to say it will hurt? Do you want me to tell you it will hurt? You don't know anything, do you? I know some things, but I don't know if it will hurt you. That's a terrible thing to say. Of course it will hurt. He looked down and considered how different the water looked from the top of the bridge. It was flat and black, like a parking lot. I could do it, you know. I suppose you could. You've come further than most people who consider doing it after the sun sets. How many have done it before me? Too many. You don't even know that. You don't even know what today is, do you? I know more than you think I know. She knew what day it was and forced herself to get out of the bed that morning. She knew all the names of all the people who fell from the old bridge, but not the new one. I know it hurts the people you leave behind. You don't know anything. But she knew a lot. You sound nice. You sound... She hesitated and wondered if it would be inappropriate to tell him that he sounded handsome. You sound tall. He laughed. I wouldn't be so tall if I did it. What a fool. She'd be glad if I did it. Neither one of them spoke for a while. Brown pelicans crashed at the surface of the water beneath him, and he knew the mackerel were there, and he wished he was in a boat with his father. Did you do it? She smiled because she liked him, and she knew that he hadn't done it. No one who called her ever did it because she listened to them and asked them questions, and she never told them not to do it. You think you're funny, don't you? A cargo ship approached the shoreline and navigated itself past the island with the lighthouse on it. You really shouldn't say something like that to me. What should I say? You should say, don't do it. You should say it will hurt. The ship looked like a toy as it turned south and into the mouth of the bay. Don't do it. It will hurt. Her voice dimmed like the sun. Do you mean it? Because I would do it. I mean it. For the first time since he'd called her, he had the idea to ask her how she was feeling. What's wrong? He leaned forward against the red box under the reflective road sign. Emergency phone. Crisis helpline. You're not the only one who feels alone, you know? Do you want to talk about it? The approaching ship blew its horn at a sailboat crossing a shipping channel too close in front of it. Was that a ship? She asked. Yes. He squinted in the darkness of the bay and saw the rust-colored cargo container stacked high above the waterline. A cargo ship. There was another long pause, and the man switched the phone to his other hand again. Are you still there? Yes. She thought about her classroom and her teacher and the sound the door made when the principal came in to tell them all about the accident. I was just thinking about it again. The ship was nearly beneath the man, and the crew prepared the boat for port. The salt air reminds me of my father, too, she sighed. Is he still alive? No. Did he work on a ship? The boat disappeared beneath his feet, and he smelled the diesel exhaust from the large smokestack, which barely fit beneath him. No. He was on the old bridge when it happened. The man felt ashamed. He knew about the old bridge and the cargo ship that lost its way and the Greyhound bus in the red pickup truck driving to work. "Are you still there?" she asked. "I'm here. Aren't you going to say anything? He didn't know what to say. There was another long silence as he considered the things that people had said to comfort him. "It's okay. They're there. Don't fret." But he didn't say any of those things because he knew they didn't work. If he hadn't taken me to school that morning, isn't that something? He died because I had a stomach ache. The man realized that he didn't know everything either. The sun set. A single cloud lingered above the horizon like an orange mistake on his dark canvas. "It really is beautiful here." "It is. I just hate the cargo ships," she said. "And the tourists," he reminded her. The man peeked over the side of the bridge but couldn't see the water anymore. Tires hummed behind him. He breathed in and closed his eyes and told himself that he could still do it, even though he didn't want to anymore. "What's your name?" she asked. "Robert." Blue and white lights flashed in the distance at the bottom of the bridge, and darkness filled the bay. A Coast Guard cutter positioned itself in the water beneath him. "Please don't do it, Robert." "Why not?" "It will hurt if you do it." "I don't care if it hurts." "It won't hurt you if you do it." "It will hurt me." The bridge hunched itself over the bay like an inchworm. Spotlights from the bridge pointed up at the yellow spans of steel that came to a point in the black sky like the sun. "I don't want to hurt anyone." He took a deep breath, but didn't hold it this time. "What's your name?" "Lisa." "I don't want to hurt you, Lisa." "I know you don't. But it hurts so bad sometimes." "I know it does. What time does the sun set tomorrow?" She smiled and wiped a tear from her cheek. "I don't know. I mean, the sun never really sets, does it?"
Oh, wow. That was so beautiful.
Thank you. I wrote that.
Hits home.
Thank you. You know, I obviously hope everybody out there, anybody listening, struggling, just talk, you know. Find somebody who will listen and not tell you what's just, I think just talking and listening is just so important, especially now, you know, now more than ever.
Yeah.
So really important to me to try to get that message out there.
And thank you. 'Cause I lost a friend on the, well, I'm thinking that's based on the Skyway Bridge. So I'm assuming. Yeah. Yes. I lost a friend on my birthday about 5 years ago. So thank you for sharing it. Yeah. Yeah.
Kidding me.
He was a part of the art community in St. Pete. And yep. What's crazy is the kids from Eckerd College have a rescue team that go out.
And, I know.
Yeah, it's wild.
So sorry. I mean,
yeah.
I
none of us really knew. It was really shocking for all of us that. He left his girlfriend's side and went, and he loved to go over to the Skyway. That was his getting, you know, just, it's such a beautiful drive, and he had a convertible, and it was just like his way to like relax. And but who knows if that was him planning, or you never know what's in the head of somebody.
I like to think that if someone's going to do something, that there's nothing that you could have done to prevent it, because they're probably going to be pretty good at keeping a secret. But man, wow, I just can't believe I shared that with you and you.
Well, no, you don't. I mean, we're near the Skyway, so I'm sure a lot of people have been touched by tragedy in relation to that. So,
yeah,
thank you so much for sharing that piece, Brian. It's been great talking to you.
And it's been an absolute
pleasure. You are a writer, and all of you that are out there that aren't sure if you're writers, let Brian be an example for you to keep doing it.
Thank you. And if I have like 15 more seconds, just to plug you, like Keep St. Pete Lit was actually like move one on my game board of what do I do? And I just sought out a community, and people directed me to you and what you created. And, you know, I think all writers or non-writers or whatever, we all have a DNA, a genetics, if you will, and you will be like always in my story. And I just want to thank you for what you do for the community here and beyond. And it is, if anybody out there is considering writing something or struggling with writing something, or a super successful author, I think Tap Into That Community, Keep St. Pete Lit is really wonderful. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And thank you for saying that. That means a lot. It's a labor of love. So you can find out more information about Keep St. Pete Lit about Keep St. Pete Lit at keepstpetelit.org. And we will be back with Typewriter Talks next week. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you.
Typewriter Talks features interviews with writers, poets, and other bookish folks. It is hosted by Maureen McDowell, founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit, which is a literary arts organization based in St. Petersburg, Florida. Listen in to hear discussions on all kinds of writerly topics. Our goal is to show you that there is not one right way to be a writer. Learn more about Keep St. Pete Lit at www.keepstpetelit.org.